The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Garrett.
Hi, everyone. I'm Garrett, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow. This is the AG group, right? I heard about you guys on the West Coast, because I wasn't part of the Pacific group. I just moved here a couple months ago from Santa Barbara, California, and I'm really grateful to be in this group, so thank you. First of all, I want to say what an honor it is to speak at an AG meeting. This is pretty cool. And I'm really humbled that I was asked to speak tonight. And I'm the first one. Wow. Okay, so what happened? Let's see. I was a drunk. I was that little kid in Santa Barbara, California, who dressed up in drag at 3 years old, and I was different. You know, I got bullied. I was called really bad names. I was different, and I hid behind these wonderful my mother and my grandmother and my aunts. And alcohol was around a lot in our family. My grandfather was an alcoholic. Both of my grandfathers were alcoholics, and my dad and about half of my cousins are drinkers. So, and we're German, English, and Canadian. So that was a perfect combination. So, you know, we always would have these parties all the time. So it was always like it was accustomed to drink. And so when I was 13, it was my confirmation from our Lutheran church. And champagne was being passed around. And, of course, I proceeded to get drunk that day. So, you know, it was on, basically. I wasn't that high school kid that partied a lot. Like, we used to have these society dinners, and we'd dress up in our nice vintage clothing, and we'd, like, drink champagne and listen to Breakfast at Tiffany's soundtrack and be, like, super cool and make a really nice dinner. And it was kind of like being a movie star, in a sense. So that's what my drinking started as. It wasn't until I got immersed into the gay world that the gay world seems to be about drinking and drugs. That's to really fit in, to be part of the A crowd. And so I kind of dove in really hard. It was part of the tradition to do that almost every night of the week. And I pretty much drank every night of the week. They say your drinking career gets progressive, and that definitely was my story. I drank every day, and it got to the point where my drinking career started at 9 o'clock in the morning. Drugs were a part of my story, but not a major part. But I would start at 9 o'clock in the morning with bottles of wine, and when I'd feel some pain one day, I would like drink more. And you know, it was always about buffering the pain. There was always pain in life because I was different. I was a different human being, and I couldn't even accept my own self. So I had to use alcohol as a way to buffer that pain. It wasn't until I'm not going to go through a whole drunkologue. I mean, I could go through stories of me. I remember my favorite story was on a Pan Am flight from JFK to LAX in business class, and I drank 9 rum and cokes, and I thought that was fabulous until I proceeded to throw up in baggage claim. And if I thought that was glamorous, I mean, luckily I just picked up my bag and I went to the bathroom. I had a hangover all the way home from that point on. So it was really hard because traveling was one of my favorite times I liked to drink. So through my drinking career, I finally got to a point where it was ruining my relationship. It was ruining my relationship with my mom and dad, where I proceeded to be profound with my profanity at their 40th anniversary, where I hurt my mother quite a bit. And it was then that's where it was starting to go downhill. I lost hope. I didn't know where to go. I did go to an AA meeting for a week, but I wasn't ready. I wasn't willing. I wasn't ready to just, I wasn't done yet. I had to keep on going. I had a lot of bottoms in my drinking career, but I really hadn't gotten to a point where I really, really was willing to quit. God plays a big picture in my story. I was a Lutheran boy, so I grew up with God. So that was never, ever an issue. God was always my savior. Jesus Christ was my savior. That was what we did. You know, that's what I was born and raised to do. So it was, I got this job working for HBO at the Cat House. It was that show on the Cat House on HBO. And I was an art director. It was that whorehouse in Carson City, Nevada. And a member of AG Group hired me to be the art director for that job. I ended up getting a DUI one night. And in the car, I'm handcuffed, and my phone rings, and it was her. And I hear, "Garrett, where are you?" And I go, "Hurry, jail, now." So she picks me up. She bails me out of jail. My first thing I said is, at least my mugshot came out good. I smiled. Talk about insanity. And then she was a member of AG. She was counting days. She was under 90 days. I ended up getting this television series that I shot that summer for 16 weeks. And I would drink on my days off. I wasn't willing to quit yet. The game was on. And finally, on my days off, I would drink and call people and tell them I was going to be famous. So there's my ego and fear all wrapped up into one, and I was just a miserable human being. It was that October 18th, 2006, when I had, which is my sobriety date, where I got on my knees, bawling, praying to God, and asked, "What do I do?" And I called her, and I said, "What do I do?" And she said, "Go to a meeting." She found a meeting online, and I showed up drunk. And I got picked to speak, and I didn't get that thing where they said if you had a mind-altering substance in the last 24 hours, you can't speak. Well, I did anyways. But I was that perfect alcoholic who had surrendered. I threw in the white towel. It was time. I immediately had that gift of desperation. If you do, I would just do everything you can to stay sober. Do whatever you can. Like, I jumped in so hard, and I hung around old-timers that were 25 years, 30 years sober, and they guided me through the process. They told me to get a sponsor. They told me to do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me to get a commitment. They told me to do all these things, or they suggested, and I took the suggestion. I had a sponsor. I went through two sponsors in the first year, and actually a third. I got a third, but, you know, it wasn't so easy to find a sponsor, but I wanted to find someone. I wanted what they had. And I found this amazing woman named Mayana who took me through this spiritual journey. And if you have any questions about sponsorship, there's a wonderful pamphlet that talks about sponsorship, if you have any questions. And that's what I did. And she guided me. And she guided me through the steps and the traditions. And we broke it down, like every paragraph. And it was... It uplifted me. It made me a different person. Today, I'm 9.25, it says in my little 12-step companion. 9.25 years. I'm so grateful to be part of this program. It is, you know, I was a sick man in my head. We're all sick people, right? I mean, we're here for a purpose. You know, I remember in my 4 months of sobriety, this woman named Rita, she was from New Jersey. My home group was this really cool Santa Barbara, it was called Summerland, it was our Summerland group. And it was this like super beach little town little meeting. And this woman, Rita, said, "I don't drink no matter what." And for some reason, I don't know if God was speaking through her or what it was, but I heard that. And I don't drink no matter what today. I am so grateful to be sober. And if you have any questions about how to do this, read that page 417 in the fourth edition about acceptance. I really accept that I'm an alcoholic today and that I'm a grateful member of AA. Thanks very much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Sandra.
Hi, I'm Sandra. I'm an alcoholic. Wow, okay. This is my home group, so I'm a little nervous. This is also home, and it's a safe place, so thank you for this honor of letting me speak tonight. Thank you, Judy, for asking me. November 27, 2012, that's my sobriety date. Sponsor is Nicole D. This is my home group, practicing 9 through 12. Grew up in Queens, Colombian family, very strict, religious, and I took that to the extreme. I was very paranoid, very full of fear most of my life. My immediate family was not necessarily alcoholic. My uncles, aunts, cousins, they all are very heavy drinkers and alcoholics, but there was no alcohol growing up. By the time I was 12, I felt just very uncomfortable. I hated my body, I hated my life, and I just wanted to die. And probably around the time I was 14, I found alcohol. And it was with friends, and it felt amazing. It made me feel comfortable. I felt grounded, I felt at ease, I loved everyone, and it was just a lot of fun. I started missing school, I started cutting school, and just, you know, drinking and partying a lot, and I thought that that was my purpose for the most part. When I got into college, and my first semester I was living with my best friend, I arrived moment. You know, we can drink as much as we want, and I immediately became a blackout drinker, and I thought that was normal. I did not know that that was a symptom. Other people were drinking as heavy as I was, and I continued that. Eventually became an everyday drinker in college and was academically dismissed, and only now in sobriety I can admit that that's because of alcoholism. I blamed it on depression for a long time. Around that time that I was in college, my mom did know of AA because my uncle got sober in Colombia. And my mom would tell me, Sandra, you have a problem. Sandra, you can't drink. You know, all these things that says in the book. But my mom is not an alcoholic, so I didn't believe her. And she actually dragged me to my first meeting, and I sat in the back. It was in College Point, a lot of veterans there, and I just cried. I did not really identify. I compared myself out. I was the only woman. I was the only Hispanic. I was the only young person, and I was like, I do not belong here. I'm, like, not even 20 years old. Like, I am not ready for this. Like, this is horrible. And I eventually did go back to AA a couple years later. So college, I was drinking all the time, and when things would get really ugly and really bad, I would go to a meeting, but I would sit in the back. I would come late, leave early, never raise my hand, never spoke to anyone. If somebody gave me the number, I threw it out. I never used it. And that's what I did for almost 9 years. When things got out of hand, I had a bad night, I would just go to a meeting, and I just thought I could do this on my own. I did not want this. I did not want this program. AA was the last thing. I did not want to admit I was an alcoholic. I was in so much denial. I just hated that word. Like, to say that I'm an alcoholic was just like the biggest disgrace. I was like, no, I can figure this out. And I went on a journey to try and figure it out on my own. I tried yoga, I tried running, I got a second degree black belt, I read spiritual books, and I wanted to do anything and everything that I could except come here, because I had a lot of pride, and I didn't want to say I needed help. Towards the end, I was not an everyday drinker. I was trying my hardest. That was the biggest goal in my life, was to be a social drinker. And it was not fun trying to control so much. And it failed on me. I have a physical allergy, I understand now. My body doesn't react the same way that other people. They can just have one or two drinks, thank you. I can't. Once I have one or two drinks, I don't know how the night will end. And sometimes I'll black out just after two drinks. It betrayed me. So fast forward towards the end, I managed to get into nursing school. And that was what, by periods of sobriety here and there, I would stay sober for 2 months, do really well on tests. And then once I passed the test, I'd party on again. And, you know, I was starting to see, like, okay, nobody else is partying as hard as I am. And it's, you know, party girl has to kind of grow up now. And I've managed to graduate nursing school. And my last night drinking, I got woken up by two different cab drivers. And that's happened before. But for some reason, it finally scared me. And I thought of all the times that I've had so many not yets. You know, I crashed a car. The guy didn't call the cops, so I didn't get a DUI. I got arrested, but they didn't put handcuffs on me. So my consequences weren't as bad as what I heard in the rooms. So I had all these reasons as to why I wasn't an alcoholic. And that morning, my last night drinking, I had started my dream job working in the emergency room, and I almost walked into work thinking after coming home 5:30 in the morning, thinking I could go into work and insert IVs and give medications. And luckily, my mom did not let me leave the house that night. That morning, I had that moment of grace where I was just like, I can't do this anymore. And it was more of an emotional bottom. Like I said, nothing different happened that night, but the demoralization, the guilt, the remorse, I just could not go one more day living like that anymore. So I called this woman that I knew was sober, and I had called her throughout the years. And every time I would call her, I would, you know, tell her, okay, I think I'm ready, or it's bad. And she would give me all the suggestions that is said in the book, you know, try not drinking 30 days, try this, try that. And she always picked up the phone. I mean, till this day, I'm so grateful for her. Her name is Arlena. She met up with me the next day, and I told her, where do I go? She gave me the list to this meeting. She's like, try this group. I call it the pretty people group. So I was like, okay. So I came, and I raised my hand, and I said, I'm Sandra, I'm an alcoholic. I had 7 days, and that was like the hardest thing ever. So if you knew, I know how you feel. I was in line to the bathroom, and this woman came up to me, and she was just like, you have 7 days? I was like, yeah. She's like, you need a sponsor? I was like, yeah. I didn't know how you could say no. And she's like, I'll sponsor you. I was like, okay. She took me through the steps, and I managed to get a year, so I thought. I had a watch, and a month or two later, I realized that I wasn't really living sober. I had done the steps, but something was still missing. I was still reaching out for another substance. I know alcohol is my primary purpose here, but I was still smoking marijuana. Not that often, but it sounds so stupid when I say it, but I really did not do it like secretly. It just like one day I was just like, oh my God, nobody told me. Oh my God, nobody else is doing this. So I had to start all over, count days again here. It was one of the hardest things ever because of my pride and ego, but nobody cared. Everyone was just glad that I was back and I didn't go anywhere. And then when I had a real year, came up here, gave my money back, and made an amends to the group. Just 1 minute left. Just this past year has been, I mean, the ups and downs. Life continues to happen. You know, my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and I was going through my third step for the third time, and it was just like, my higher power always gives me examples of of what I need exactly when I'm working on certain steps. And it was just like constantly turning it over minute by minute. And I really had to just keep it in the day. And, you know, luckily my mom is okay now. I've went to Atlanta. I've gone on sober trips. You know, I did all these things that I did not want to do before. I didn't want to change my life. Like that first year that I was here and I had to restart, you know, I didn't fellowship as much. I had maybe one service commitment. I didn't call women. I didn't, you know, do a lot of the things. And now I just throw myself into the program. And I used to sit sometimes in the back where there's a bench outside and a little speaker on top. I don't suggest doing that. And now I try to sit close up front. Thank you for my sobriety.
And now for tonight, our main speaker is Mark.
Hi, my name is Mark and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, bro. My sobriety date is January 20th, 1996. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Bob W. And I'm living in 10, 11, and 12. I say those things. Thank you. I say those things to show you what actions I'm taking as opposed to how I'm feeling. My feelings are important. They are. But it's very easy for my feelings to be blowing south at 20 and go north at 50 in a heartbeat. And if I take sober actions, those will change. If I take non-sober actions, those will change as well. And I just have to keep doing the next right thing. The things that got me one day and 3 days and 5 days and 10 years or whatever it is, well, it'll get me to the next point. If I just keep taking the next right action, keep chopping wood, I'm going to be fine. And one of the biggest things I've learned for me, my mantra for the last 2 years, is that this too will pass. And it always does, and it never doesn't. I always think it doesn't. Like this particular thing is much more important than the last 4,000 things. And those things were easy to pass, but this definitely won't. And my experience is that my worst enemy is between my ears. And that's the thing I need to remember. And that's why I call people. That's why I have a sponsor. That's why I get on my knees. I humble myself. That's why I do the things I need to do. And I continue to do those things. You know, we don't sprint. We have a marathon. We run a marathon every single day. I started drinking at 6 years old. My first drink was at six. Let's clarify that. I started drinking it at six. My first drink was at six. And my father was a Navy guy, and he used to do gardening and stuff. And he sent me up to get him a beer, fetch him a beer. So I'm coming back, and I have the glass in one hand, and it was a Munich beer. It's a long time ago. And it was a white and gold can with a blue label, and I had popped the top, and I was walking down the stairs, and I don't know why, but it just felt like a good idea to take a pull. So I took one, and he saw that, and he thought that was awfully cute. So he told me, that one's yours. Yeah, that one's all you. So I turned around, went back, got him one, and I had arrived. And I can't tell you that it was a mind-changing, life-changing moment for me. But the first time I went out and got drunk was, and what that was is I'm a thief, retired, and we pooled our resources, a couple of us, and we bought a bottle of Tango, and which is like a screwdriver, but with like Fanta and whatever. So we got that, and we went behind the Long Island College Hospital library, and we took a couple pulls, and I ended up doing most of the bottle. And one of the things for me is that all of a sudden, like, I felt like De Niro, you know, like you talking to me, you know. And when I was very nervous around the young ladies, I could look over and go, "Hey, how you doing?" You know, and it for me, it all of a sudden, everything was fine. everything was completely okay. Like for me, alcohol was the fear killer. And I got to be honest, that first day, I chased the tail of that dragon till the end, and I never caught that tail again, ever, not once. I hear people talking about, you know, great days drinking, and I never had great days drinking. I had days that weren't so bad. And I pretty much want to just say one drunk, one story, and then I'm going to move forward. Me and a couple guys, and I used to dress the story up and say we borrowed that. We robbed the hospital, and we had a bunch of stuff. And we had a couple of bottles of Chivas Regal. That's why I always say whenever I see a bottle of Chivas Regal, I finally remember my first arrest. So we went to my friend's house, and we were drinking this stuff and doing this other stuff. And I come out of this blackout. I blacked out, and I come out listening to Judas Priest, Hellbent for Leather, and a long time ago. And my friend is hanging out the window with a rifle shooting at things. So we decided it was a pretty decent idea to get him back inside. We got that done. And at that point, we had run out of liquor, so we went outside to get some more. And I blacked out when I hit the fresh air. And when I came to, I was covered in blood. I had this guy pinned on the floor, and I was crawling him up him like a ladder. I had my knife open in my teeth. I was going to tune this guy up. So by the time I got to the top there, the thing that brought me out of the blackout was the lights and sirens reflecting off of the prison. You know, keyword there, prison. And the book says we're doing incredibly tragic things, and I do things in front of prisons. I do things in front of police stations. I do things in front of priests and my mother. I do crazy stuff. You know, so I get off the guy, you know, I guess once I come to, I get off the guy, I give him a shot because, you know, obviously he was wrong. And they had about 20 feet to run before they locked me up and brought me to jail. Now, you take that and you multiply that, you know, pour that in a coffee can, you know, me running over roofs in Port Chester, New York, half naked, robbing my mom a couple of hundred times, carrying guns, doing all kinds of wonderful things. And we cannot forget going to the bathroom myself a bunch of times and doing all that good stuff. And you put that in a coffee can, shake it up, pour it on the table, and you got my drunk of luck. And the most important thing for me was when I ran into my ex-wife, and we both drank quite hard. It's not for me to say she was an alcoholic. That's none of my business. But at one point, she decided that there was a bottle in the, and I'm getting all nervous all of a sudden. I was doing great, and now all of a sudden, pew, pew. Crash and burn. That's a good thing. It's God shaking the truth out of me. So she asked me to go downstairs and get something. Like a wonderfully obedient husband, I said no. At that point, she pushed me, and I ended up going. But for whatever reason, I looked at the bottle before I went downstairs, and it was right at the top of the label. Went downstairs, got whatever it was, came back upstairs, and again, whatever reason, I looked at the label, and it was below the label. So I jumped on her, and she's an alcoholic, and you have all these problems, and blah, blah, blah. So we're going to stop drinking. So let's go to AA. I said, I'm not going there. It's like a crutch. Stop all that. Man up. Do what you got to do. Look at where I am now. Thank God. So I white-knuckled it for 6 years and 5 months. I was still getting locked up. I was still, all those things that was still happening. I just wasn't drinking. I mean, I was stopping my car 70 miles an hour in the FDR Drive, getting out, and, you know, insane stuff. Because I was drunk without drinking, you know. So long story short, I started working for a gentleman. He didn't like me too much. I didn't like him too much, his son. And he found out that I didn't drink, so he told me that he was going to bring me back to the gutter like the animal that I was. So he started pouring glasses for me and putting them on my desk and handing me glasses of liquor and all those things. And then one day he called me upstairs, and again, he's my boss, so I kind of have to go. So I went up there, and as I hit the door, he threw a bottle of Wild Turkey in my chest, and I caught it. I hit it, and I just looked at it and said, the heck with it, you know? So I cracked the bottle and smelled it, and the crack just ran right down me, and I was done. I knew it. He knew it. It was over. And, you know, coincidence, these speakers, the loudspeakers came on. It was his father from Florida, and he had to get the phone. So at this point, I just bolted. I went downstairs. I got my jacket, left the phones ringing, and I walked out of work. And I went home and told my ex, listen, I'm going to drink. You know, that's it. I'm done. And coincidence, she got a phone call from my in-law at the time, Patty B, and Patty broke her anonymity. And so she said, well, why don't you give Patty a call? And I did. And coincidence, Patty didn't go to work that day. And coincidence, at the time, she didn't have an answering machine at the house. It's one of those ones that somewhere else in the phone company, and she had that turned on. She had turned off, but she didn't answer any of the calls. The only call she answered was mine. Coincidence. Coincidence, it happened to be Friday, so I didn't have to see that gentleman till Monday. So she spoke to me for about an hour or two, and she, you know, asked me, okay, do you think you can make it till tomorrow? Meet me in the meeting. So I went to my first meeting in Hohokus, New Jersey, of all places. And I'm a Brooklyn guy, so that's Hohokus, Jesus. So I walk into this place, and the first speaker, or the speaker, the main speaker, was this big gentleman with a pink shirt, this tremendous guy. He's wearing a pink shirt. And they say if you go to meetings long enough, you know, you'll hear your story. And that guy told my story. I told the Jersey version of my story, but he told my story. And and I was amazed, although I had, as Dominic once said, and Amy reminded me, don't get Charles Manson on your face, because I get that Stone Cold thing going on. And Dominic used to walk up to me and rub my face, go, get that off your face. And I have to remember that. So I had that on my face at the moment. And when I walked up to Patty, she's like, what do you think? I said, yeah, he was all right. And in my mind, I'm going, how did he know those things about me? How did he know how I felt? How did he know? I did those things. I felt like that. You know, and in our book, it says, well, maybe this can work for me as well. And somewhere in the back of my head, I was thinking that. I left that meeting with the smallest thing, and I never knew what it was. And it took me about 3 years to figure out what that was. I walked out of there with the tiniest sliver of hope. And by doing all the things we do, by getting a sponsor, by going to meetings, by humbling myself, by getting on my knees, by finding a God, by developing a relationship with that God, by humbling myself enough to shut up and listen to the guys that tell me what to do and not ask, yeah, why, and but, and all this other stuff. Just shut up and do it. And that's the thing I learned to do. And so she said, why didn't you think he was all right? Why didn't you go up and say something? So I walked over, and I put my hand out. He shook my hand, and I did that to him. Yeah, my best nod, you know? I'm kind of half crippled now, so it was much better a couple years ago. But I gave my best nod. So he started talking to me. He said, hey, don't kid. What's going on? You like the meeting, and where you from, and you got a meeting book, and you want to go out for a bite to eat? And so he will not stop talking. And I have... At that point, I feel I have a ton of street skills, but I don't, thank God I didn't have any life skills. So as he's holding my hand, and I think it's time to go, so I start like kind of walking back this way, and he's following me, like he's holding onto my hand. And by the time we get about the 30 feet to the door, I'm like, you know, would you mind, dude? And he's like, finally, he's like, yeah, sure. So he gives me his number, and he's like, call me. I didn't call him, but I'm not gonna lie. But I learned something. And what I learned is I walked into the parking lot, and I walked up to my ex, and I said, listen, I think maybe we should make another one of these things. And I went into my second meeting. And my third meeting was a pip. I went into my third meeting, and there was a gentleman named Martin there. Martin was a complete gentleman, came running up to me and said, welcome to Brooklyn Heights. Say, hey, my name is Martin. How are you? Do you have a seat? Do you have cookies? Do you have a meeting book? Take my phone. And I'm like, dude, step off, bro. You're going to catch a shot. Go over there. And he's like, okay, keep coming back, and he runs away, which was the smartest thing Martin could have done, because someone was going to get hurt. You know, it wasn't Martin, it was me. Because Martin was going to ask me a question like, how you doing? And I couldn't do that. I know two ways to get people away from me. I slap you in the face. I love talking in front of this lady. Or I say something about one of your family members. I know ways to get you away. And it's not because I'm a tough guy, because I'm not. It's because I'm afraid of everything and everybody. And you're going to find that out unless I pop you one. So at that point, I started coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I might as well just throw it on the table right now. I had a sponsor, a gentleman named Ron, I did my fifth step with Ron, thank you. And Ron used all that information in that step to try to have sex with my wife. The thing I need to remember is that that's just Ron being Ron. You know, as crazy as it might sound, he's not doing it to me. He's just doing it. And the amazing thing about that whole thing is that he didn't walk to my mom's house, get my pistol, and blow his brains out. That's the amazing, the first thought that rolled into my mind when my wife said that was, I know where my gun is, but where are the bullets? You don't keep those things together, you know? It's a felony. It goes way up. So, and my second thought is, I have to get to a meeting. And I left her right there, and I jumped in a car, and I drove to Midnight. And I, a day at a time, a heartbeat at a time, I took the next right step. And one of the things I've learned is that I have sober feet and sober fingers. And as long as I do those things, the rest of the body parts don't really matter. Because these and those will keep everything else in line. So I ran into my next sponsor. I was very angry. I'm sharing venom from the floor, just really bad stuff. And this black woman comes up to me, she's gay, and she said to me, baby, you're with me. And she took me on, because at that point she realized I couldn't trust guys, couldn't trust women, couldn't trust anybody. I could trust her, because she has nothing going on for me, vice versa. She was in a committed relationship, I had nothing, it was perfect for me. And she could tell me to shut up. And nice and politely, oh, baby, to say, like, oh, come on, baby, zip it. And I would say, yes, ma'am, and I'd sit down, and that was the end of it. And that's what I listened to, and that's the thing I had to hold on to. Because I didn't drop my slushy margarita by the pool, come racing into Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous because one more breath of air, and I was going to die. I didn't come here on a winning streak. You know, I came here to survive and to actually get a life, because I never had one. You know, when I first met Dominic, my first real sponsor, the first thing he said to me, I'm speaking to him, and about 45 seconds into my talk, he cuts me off. He goes, in your best moments, you're a vicious bottom-feeding predator. He's paying me a compliment, because he's going light on me. And that's the truth. In my best moments, I'm a vicious bottom-feeding predator. And I eat your heart out for a quarter. And that's the way it is. And, you know, I'm a gentleman today. I'm a gentleman not because of me. I'm a gentleman because of God, Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of you. Because I do the things I'm told to do. I'm a good soldier. I had a very hard time developing a relationship with a God, because I was too busy being angry at all the things he was doing to me. I mean, if you look at me, I'm kind of bent over like a question mark, and very sexy though, but kind of bent over like a question mark. And I was very angry about that for a while. It's a pretty severe thing, and I was pretty peed. There we go. And I had to just work at it to the point where I realized that was done for a reason. And for me, the reason was is that was the only way that was going to get me to stand down, so to speak. Because if not, I'm a maniac. I get into fistfights with police officers. I crash through windows. I'm a hell of a party date. The thing that I had to remember when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was to do what I was told. So I was told to get a sponsor. I got one. I was told to read our book. I did it. I was told to follow through and to make calls. And I made calls when guys didn't call me back. I made calls no matter what. And because, again, my life depended on it. I didn't know how to pray. So with me being a dope fiend, what I did was I walked up to a priest who was an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I figured that I would get the skinny, get the inside scoop. So I said, "Father Frank, you know, I don't know how to pray. I don't believe in God. I don't know how to pray." He goes, "Son, do you have a wallet?" I said, "I do." He goes, "Do you have a bed?" I said, "Got one." He said, "Okay, take your wallet. Go home. Take your wallet. Throw your wallet under the bed. Get down on your knees. When you go to get the wallet, throw one to God." And that made a lot of sense to me. That made a ton of sense to me. And it didn't have to be this big, long thing. You know, prayer is a petition. So all I have to do is ask for something that's not selfish. And if I do that, I'm good to go. I was told to get service. You know, service is the price we pay for life. It's a gift from God. It's not something that's given to me begrudgingly. I got to go do this. I hear people all the time. I got to go do this, and I got to call this guy. I don't have to do anything. I get to. I should be in jail fighting over Jell-O and blankets, for Christ's sakes. And I'm not. I'm here with all of you in a shiny suit. And it's because of all of you. It's because I was granted a gift. And for an hour a day, you guys let me come and spend time with you. I should be grateful for that. This isn't something I get to do. That's something I have to do. This is something I get to do. So I'll tell you about my first service commitment. My first sponsor, Ron, told me, I used to make this other meeting on Sunday. He called me up. He goes, "Meet me at this one." Hung up on me. Didn't want to call him back. Met him. As I'm walking up to the meeting, he's standing there, and he has a can of coffee in his hand. He's throwing it up in the air, catching it. And as I get closer to him, close enough, about where Bonnie is, he throws the can of coffee at me, hits me in the chest. I catch it. He goes, "Congratulations, you got your first coffee commitment. Call me tomorrow. Tell me about your resentment. Good night." And he walked away. And that was my first coffee. That was my first service commitment at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was very upset about it. But the thing I learned is that very quickly, within a day, within my second time doing the commitment, I'm like, people would like rip open the sweet and lows and put it in the coffee and then throw them in. Like, you live in a barn, bro. And I had to get ratcheted down a little bit. I know it's hard to believe, but I had to get ratcheted down a little bit. And that's what I learned to do. I learned to show up. I learned to suit up. I learned to humble myself enough to shut up and listen to the people that have been here before me. My third or fourth meeting, I went into this room, and there was this gentleman, Frank, actually, I'm sorry, Frank, introduced me to this lady, Barbara. Barbara had 19 years. She was a large Jamaican lady, and introduced me to her. And she asked me how I was doing, and she said something, and then I answered the question, and I gave her some lip. I kind of talked out of the side of my neck, as we say in Brooklyn. So she puts down her coffee, she puts down her cookie, she stands up, she gets nose to nose with me, tell me, "Sit down, shut up, you're lucky to be alive." I cleaned it up a little bit. "Sit down, shut up, you're lucky to be alive." And I look her right in the face, give her my best Brooklyn, sit down, said, "Yes, ma'am." And because she was right, I was going to die. So she patted me on the head, and I looked up at her, and she said, "You're going to be okay, baby." And I tell that story every time I speak, just about, because I'm introducing you to my first higher power. Now, I understand that the book says no human power could, but I believe that God speaks through people, and God speaks through Barbara and lots of other people to me. And again, I showed up for over 90 days. Every single day, I found out which meeting she went to. I was there an hour early, and I saved seats for me and her, which one was her favorite seat. I sat right there, and keys were in that seat, and that was the end of it. And I just sat there and I did that. Now, my first 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I made 3 meetings every day at a full-time job and I was married. So you're telling me that, you know, I'm having a hard time getting to the meeting 3 times, 4 times a week. No, no, no. I mean, that's the way I see it. What do I know? I had between 12 and 17 service commitments a week. Thank you. So, and I'm not saying go get 12 or 17 service commitments a week. But I'm saying, for me, I have to remember that this is a gift and this is something I get to do. And I have to remember that. That this is something that I get to give back. You know, if I'm not doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, I'm stealing. I can't speak for anybody else. So, what I would encourage you to do is, you know, our book begs of us. So I would beg of you. And what I would beg of you to do is to do all the things you don't want to do. If you're a sponsor, if you don't have one, get one. And if it doesn't go well for you, come back, tell me I'm a jerk and walk away. I'm good with it. Get a home group. You know, the importance of a home group is that when you go there and you're all got Charles Manson on your face and people ask you what's going on, you go, fine. How you doing? Fine. I said fine. They'll say, oh, come on, it's okay. And then the next thing you know, it's not fine, and you're okay, and you're talking to them, and they're laughing. And they're not laughing at you, they're laughing with you. Because they've been there, they've done that. You know, importance of doing service commitments. Again, people get to know me. I'm getting there early. I'm being social. Where my middle name should be Andy, because I'm antisocial. And it pushes me to do the next right thing. I need to find a higher power. Does it have to be God? Does it have to be Jesus Christ? It has to be something that you feel is a higher power to you. Doesn't matter what it is, as long as you got one. And for me, it's better that I get on my knees and pray, because for me, if I'm getting on my knees, I'm humbling myself. Do you have to? No. Whatever works for you, whatever floats your boat. You know, I think for me, the most important thing I would ask you to do is don't draw any lines in the sand. Don't worry about what people are thinking or what they're saying, because guess what? When you're laying on the hood of your car urinating on yourself, what do you think they're saying then, bro? Come in to Alcoholics Anonymous. Do what you have to do. If you can't do 90 days, do 30 days. And see if things don't get a hair better. Just a hair. But do the things you're told to do. Don't come sit in the back and don't say anything. You get here late, leave early. Don't do that. Get here on time. Get here early. If the meeting starts at 7, get here at 1:45. Get here at 1:40. Talk to a couple people. Say hello. Stay a little afterwards. Maybe we'll get a burger. If I'm there, I'll buy a grilled cheese sandwich. And then after 30 days of doing those things, read what you're told to do, humble yourself, let's start to find a prayer life, do something small, little stuff. You don't have to do not even all of it. Do some of it. And if things don't get a hair better, find me. I'm usually back there someplace. Tell me to, and then you're on your way. Because one of the things that I've learned is that things will get worse. Your misery will be refunded for me. For me. One of the things I want to just talk about real quick was I was told on several occasions that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, in sobriety, that I was going to die. I was told twice that I had a liver issue and I had another issue with my lungs, and I was done. Pack it in, you're over, goodbye. And the first time that happened, I was pretty upset, and I had about 15 months. I didn't know how to handle it. I was very angry, and I would come into the rooms and yell about it. And what a young lady shared, Gloria, she talked about how she learned that maybe that was God's will. Maybe God's will was for me to go through that, but people to see me go through that like a gentleman. So I changed my tune. I kept my mouth shut. I got more service commitments. And when I found out that that was not the case and they were mistaken, I yelled and screamed and cursed at God. Did. Second time that happened, when I had 5 years, when that same thing happened, they lost the results and I had to go back again and they did all that stuff. And then they said, oh, we made a mistake. It wasn't this, it was this. Bad, but I'm not dying. This time I didn't curse and scream and yell at God. I got on my knees in the middle of Madison Avenue and I prayed and I thanked God for keeping me safe, sane, and sober. And I didn't have to tell 1,000 people the second time. I told 2 people, my sponsor and my closest friend at Alcoholics Anonymous. So what I would say is, please do the things you don't want to do. Stop scratching stuff that's not itching. And stop scratching stuff that's not itching and just slow things down. It's, you know, who's that guy that always says to me? If we had a theme song, our theme song would be, I am always on my mind. So, Kendi, I'm always on my mind. So all I would say is just relax and let go. Don't worry about it. It's going to be okay. This too will definitely pass. And there's another speaker named Sandy B. And he always talks about all the time that, you know, Jesus Christ, when they put the nails through his palms, what did he say? He said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So when someone takes you, puts you in a parking spot, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Do what you're told to do and show up. Thanks so much.